it's Chase Masterson, Lita from Star Trek Deep Space Nine and founder of Pop Culture Hero Coalition. And yay, you are listening to the Shuttle Pod.
Welcome back, friends. We are excited to beam you on board to Shuttle Pod episode 41. We keep patting ourselves on the back for our accomplishments here, and next Shuttle Pod will be our Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy episode number 42. Anyway, but today's 41, and I'm here with some very good friends of mine. Going in alphabetical order, we have Mr. Brian Drew.
Hello, everybody.
Dr. Kayla Iacovino.
That's me. Hey, guys.
And Matt Wright, returning by popular demand.
Ooh, hey, guys.
Good to have you all on board. Okay, so we are getting to something that we've wanted to do for a while. We are finally getting to a review of a retrospective of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. But before we get into that, I just have a little topical thing I wanted to mention. Have you guys seen this movie, any of you, this French movie, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets?
I have not heard great things.
Yeah. No, it's a kids movie. It's like trying to tap into the Hunger Games type of vibe. But I wanted to briefly touch on something they do in the opening that's really clever. They do this montage of mankind's journey into space in this fictional future, where first we see like an American and a Russian, and they meet at the International Space Station, and they shake hands. And then it fast forwards a few years, and we see there's a Chinese astronaut, and he comes and shakes the American hands. Then fast forward a few years later, and it's an Arab astronaut. A few years later, it's an African astronaut. Then a few years later, it's an alien astronaut who meets them. And it's this wonderful montage of like humanity being united and going out into the future, and all to set to David Bowie's Ground Control to Major Tom. And it's just this wonderful
space
montage.
Space Oddity.
Yeah. It's
that sounds great, actually.
It's actually more Star Trek-y than anything that happened in the Kelvinverse movies. So I was watching that just thinking, this is beautiful. This is a wonderful thing for people to see. The rest of the movie is kind of kid stuff. But if you get a chance to catch just the first 5 minutes or so, it's good Star Trek-y goodness. So that's just the little plug I wanted to give.
Is this the movie that the guy who did Fifth Element
exactly
made?
Yes.
Oh yeah, because
yes.
It looks like really intriguing. I'm kind of sad to hear that it turned out
visually
to be a
whole lot
stunning.
Of nothing. Otherwise, thin.
It's not bad. It's just not aimed at us, right? And I mean, if you're over the age of 14, you could only appreciate it ironically. But visually, it's beautiful. Anyway.
Yeah, Luc Besson, everything he makes is gorgeous.
Yeah, and you can tell he cares about everything he does, too. I mean, this is like some French comic based on a French comic book from like the 60s or 70s or something. And he's been a fan of it his whole life. So you can tell it was a real labor of love for him to be able to do this.
Very cool.
Yeah. Anyway, I just said we like to support all good science fiction here at Trek Movie. And speaking of good science fiction. How do you like that for a transition? Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about The Final Frontier, one of the perhaps less beloved installments in the franchise. Now, I know which of us have rewatched it recently? Brian, you said you rewatched it, right?
I did a couple last night.
Kayla and Matt, when was the last time you crossed the Great Barrier?
I was on a plane recently, and I had downloaded it onto my iPad and watched it on the plane. So just a few days ago, actually.
Oh, perfect.
Oh, that's good.
Perfect. Matt?
Me, quite a while. But the disclaimer is, this was the first Trek movie I ever saw in theaters as a kid. It's actually pretty ingrained in me. And thinking about it and reflecting on it and listening to the soundtrack, you know, a little bit, but just before we started, it all came back and I'm like, oh, I totally remember like all this, you know, all these scenes. So, you know, I don't really need to rewatch, I think. I think it all sort of came back to me.
That's really cool. This was the first Star Trek movie you ever saw. What did you think of it at the time? Do you remember that?
Well, so remember, I'm seven, right? And it's, you know, here's my heroes on the big screen finally, because I was not quite old enough to see The Voyage Home in theaters. So, you know, here I am at seven. And honestly, I thought it was great because, you know, it's a movie, right? So you don't really necessarily question a lot of it. And until, well, you know, maybe you come home and you reflect on it a little bit, but really I didn't question it until maybe a couple years later, you know, because we'll get into a lot of this, but I didn't mind, again, 7 year old, right? I didn't mind some of the really goofy humor that's worked into this because I just thought it was like funny. I'm like, oh, great. This is, I mean, that's maybe very telling what Shatner wrote to perhaps, but as a 7 year old, I thought some of those little gags and stuff were friggin' great. Right. Mm. And so I didn't see it as being quite corny or perhaps not quite in character as you start to think about it and see it, you know, as you get a little older and a little more perspective on it. I just thought it was fun. Right. There's a lot of fun. It's sure it's weird that Spock has like a half brother out of nowhere, but okay, you
See,
know
that is the thing that least bothers me about this film.
Ooh. Right, and I think you have a good point there. There's a lot of tone, like weird tone problems and weird themes that perhaps are more bothersome. Like when you reflect on it, I think that's a good point.
Kayla, what were your impressions from when you rewatched it on the plane recently?
Well, I hadn't seen the movie in a while, and it's not one that I know the best compared to the other Star Trek movies. So it was a lot of, you know, of course I remembered the main plots, but there were little moments that I was just like, holy crap, I completely forgot that they did that. And it's super weird. There's just a, like, I found the film very awkward. I found the little gags too corny. And I found that not only did most of the plot points not really make much sense to me, but also I this is something I wanted to ask you guys, like, I don't know what this movie is about.
I don't know if anyone does, honestly.
What is the plot of this film? And if you say, you know, oh, it's they're going in search of God, that doesn't happen till about halfway through the film. We had about, I think I timed it, it was over like over 20 minutes until they get out of Yosemite.
Really?
Something like that. It was a long time anyway. It was you know, somewhere between like 12 to 20 minutes. Something like that. It was too long of them just like hanging around a campfire. I was like, why? What is the point of this?
Yeah.
The irony of that, of course, is that the Yosemite stuff is easily the best part of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Lots of that is classic.
But it is the
nice
most watchable.
Stuff.
Yeah. This character building and all this. But it doesn't, I don't think it pushes the plot anywhere. It's sort of icing.
Sure. You could definitely argue that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Brian, what was your impression from your recent rewatch?
The same I've always had about the movie is that at its core, I think it's trying to be a good movie. It wants to be a good movie, but it's not a good movie.
Yeah.
It wants to be spiritual. It has things to say about our belief systems and I guess Kel is right. The movie doesn't really have a plot and it doesn't really lock in on its theme as much as it should. I don't know. I need to start over. I'm kind of like rambling here.
I thought that was pretty good, to be honest, because that's sort
that
of my reaction.
Good.
Like it's like the movie leaves me somewhat speechless.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah,
it's incoherent too, just like you felt. It's an incoherent movie. You know what I mean?
It's got nice little moments in it.
Yeah,
but it's a mess. I mean, and if you want to go back to like how people reacted the first time they saw this movie, this was probably the first Star Trek movie when I was close to adulthood. I was 16 when this came out, and I went with a bunch of my friends. You know, the days of going to the movies with mom and dad were over by then, and I remember asking several of my friends to go with me, and some of them were interested and some of them really weren't, but they went. And I remember walking out with them afterwards and apologizing for bringing them to the movie.
Yeah, I did that with the Planet of the Apes remake 15 years ago. I convinced my friends.
That was pretty awful. Yeah. But I just like, I remember walking out of that theater and feeling like the Star Trek had just died.
Well, and as we
know, I really did.
As we know, it almost did, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to remember something else. In June of 1989, TNG had just finished its second season, and nobody knew how long Star Trek Next Generation would last either. TNG still hadn't found itself. You got this movie coming out, so I thought Star Trek was on like life support by then. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if there'd be another Star Trek movie. I mean, maybe there was going to be a third or fourth season of Star Trek The Next Generation, but who the hell knew?
Yeah.
So when this movie came out, it certainly put the original cast in a very perilous position.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And not a good time. I mean, in retrospect, I don't hate the movie as much as I hated it in 1989. I mean, the movie has its charms here and there, and it's not the worst movie in the entire canon.
I agree.
That's reserved for Nemesis.
Yep.
But
yep.
Yeah.
Nemesis doesn't even like itself. Yeah. I mean, this movie.
That's true. That's this a movie good point.
This movie wants to be good.
Yeah.
And people look like they're fairly enjoying themselves, you know, making it for the
with
most
one
part.
Or two notable exceptions.
That's very true. Okay, most people. I mean, we'll talk about that. That's true.
Yeah, we'll get to that. No, but the other thing with Nemesis is just there are no scenes in it that are like even the wedding scene has no charm to it. Whereas with this. Right. Like I say, the Yosemite stuff, I really like that. I mean, even though, like, some of the special effects, like when Shatner is falling, look kind of terrible, it's still a fun scene, right? And, like, with McCoy, like, watching him with the binoculars cursing up a storm, like, that's good McCoy stuff right there. And then, like, Kentucky bourbon in the chili. I mean, this is all vintage character stuff. And I want to say, what is this movie about? So something to talk about is the stated theme of the movie is usually – something that the hero says or hears and doesn't really grasp in the first act, and then by the end the hero restates it and they've learned the lesson. And with this, I think the stated theme is other men have family bones, we don't, right? And then at the end, after their adventure, Kirk says, you know, you guys are my family. And so that's the theme. Mm-hmm. The question is, how well does everything that happens fit onto that theme? Right,
like not at all for me.
Not so well.
It doesn't yet.
Yeah, it doesn't. You could go and sort of string that along and go, oh well, look, you know, Spock figures out that he has a half brother, like quite literally extended family, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, it doesn't work super well. You're right.
No.
I never got it. And then there's just I have so many questions about this movie. Like, how come he can mind control people?
So that's actually one of the points I definitely wanted to talk about was what little mix of tricks is this? Because so we know Vulcans, of course, are slightly telepathic, like, you know, without touch as well. They can kind of approach people and sense a little bit. We know, of course, that mind melds can do something. So I had this thought just noodling this through in the car, I think, yesterday on my way home, thinking, okay, so how would he do this knowing what we know about Vulcans? And my only thought about this, see what you guys think, is so he definitely does touch people. So he is mind melding with them. Mm-hmm. So I think what he's doing, because he's quite the you know, the sham artist. He's, you know, he's totally like grifting people, basically. Right.
Yeah, but he does believe in what he's selling.
I disagree with that. He's not. I don't think he's not a con man. He's very earnest.
You don't think so?
Yeah, and I think
I don't think Cybok is a con man either.
Yeah, and he comes across as one.
I get that.
See, he's definitely got
genuinely believes everything.
Right, exactly. Because he's all shocked at the end, and by the way, I think he like changes his mind way too quickly at the end.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden,
he's like,
I was wrong about everything in my entire life.
He's not a flim flam man, to use a Picardism. Okay, so in terms of our three mains, our Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, how did these three fare in this movie? How do they fare individually, and how does their relationship come across after almost 25 years of hopping galaxies together?
The relationship stuff in this movie is great.
Yeah.
I think they come across very well. They talk, for the first time, I think, in the history of the original Star Trek series, they kind of talk about their friendship. And what they mean to one another and things, you know, it's a very like touchy feely kind of little moment for the men of the Enterprise.
Yeah, it really is. There's some definite like bromance moments in the best way.
Yeah, and I think, in the best way.
Yeah, in the best way.
It's actually a really sweet, for the most part, it's a very sweet little scene amongst them.
So, and how does that relationship continue throughout the rest of the movie? Like, does it Does it work well after the Yosemite stuff? I mean, like when they're in the brig together?
So I think the brig part works out because we have that really great scene with Shatner being very Shatner about, well, you couldn't possibly have a brother, you know, Spock. Well, I happen to know for a fact you don't have a brother. Mm-hmm. And it's a great almost, you know, sibling thing of like, well, how could this be? I thought you were my bro. Like, I should know everything about you, which of course we know that Spock is very secretive anyway. But he feels, especially after 25 years or whatever, voyaging with him, right? He should know everything. And so it's just literally not possible to Kirk that there could be this other aspect to his life, right? And so it's played wonderfully, I think, where he's just like, it's not possible, you know? And of course, Spock is like, well, technically you're correct. You know, I don't have a brother, but I have a half brother, you know?
And I like how his reaction to that is, oh, I got to sit down.
Spock does say, I've never been predisposed to discuss matters of a personal nature.
Exactly.
Oh.
So basically, if you don't ask, he's not going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
That's Spock's general attitude. And that makes sense in the original series, too, because he never told anybody that his father was the Vulcan ambassador.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Nobody knew who Sark and Amanda were. Mm-hmm. You know, Spock did not say a word.
Nope.
I mean, now, granted, I'm sure it was in Spock's file, but he kept it to himself. So, I mean, I didn't think it was ridiculous that Spock wouldn't say anything. I just feel it was the whole idea of bringing, like, a half-brother out of the woodwork was just kind of like this bad soap opera cliche.
Yeah, that's definitely a soap opera part. But their interplay is really great. The two of them in the Sprig scene is really, like, fun and very, you know, sort of two best friends and then one of them drops kind of a bombshell and, you know, it's like, that's not possible. I've known you forever. How could that be, you know, moment?
How do we feel that Star Trek V fits canonically in terms of the way the movies are set up? Like, does it continue the through line from 4 to 6 pretty well?
Yeah, it seems out of place.
Well, it does.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I was younger, you know, to go back to Matt, to when you say when you originally saw it, I remember my dad, when he saw it, he said, you know, it seemed like this would have made more sense earlier, before all the stuff from, like, Spock dying and coming back to life, right? Because Spock comes off as actually kind of dumb through a lot of this. Like, not being able to pronounce marshmallow when Cybok is coming and he's got the gun pointed at him and Kirk says shoot him and he doesn't shoot him. It's like Spock could have still like nerve pinched him or shot him in the knee.
Yeah, or shot
whatever.
Him in the leg. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there's a line in Firefly when the preacher says the Bible is very clear about how you shouldn't kill, but it's very vague on the subject of kneecaps. It's like or neck pinch him. I mean, Spock has a very good nonviolent way of incapacitating people.
And he would be able to, I feel like he would have been able to control his emotions in that moment to act logically, and he didn't, which is out of character.
Yeah. And so maybe this stuff would have made more sense before Wrath of Khan and all that, because he's pretty wise in the Voyage Home, and the lessons that he learns about marrying his Vulcan and human halves is beautiful in that, and here it's just all out the door.
Is it?
Okay, well, it's not all out the door, but it does seem like,
I mean, that whole scene later on when Cybok tries to convert him basically, and he shows him his birth.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole bit with Sark saying so human, and then and Cybok is convinced that that's gonna do the trick, and then Spock says, "You're my brother, but you not know me. I am not that child that you knew so many years ago. I have found myself. I know who I am.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Right. I know who I am, and I cannot go with you. Like Spock, this Spock knows exactly what he's doing. Now, whether he's maybe a little dense in this movie, yeah, I mean, you can make that argument, but I disagree that he hasn't. He's not carrying the lessons he has learned in previous adventures.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that scene. I do like that line when they're on Nimbus 3 when he says, I'm not the outcast boy you left on Vulcan so many years ago. Right? That is good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. It is just kind of weird how he doesn't – he comes off as a little dumb in that one scene. Anyway.
Yeah, and the marshmallow thing, if I remember correctly, the marshmallow thing is in the novel. Apparently, McCoy had a little fun with Spock before they left the Enterprise and – altered the camping files in the Enterprise's computer to have like all sorts of like silly mistakes in them. Someone, because he knew Spock would is the kind of person that would do research on camping before he went.
I think that might be in the comic adaptation too, because I had the comic to go with this, because I was seven, I had the comic, I had everything to go with this,
right? Which is why Spock calls it a marshmallow, because McCoy had been messing around with the Enterprise's library computer.
That's pretty funny.
All right, well, is there anything we want to say about Kirk specifically? Because I know one of the criticisms of this movie is it's just an ego trip for Shatner. And you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to argue with that when the first 5 minutes of the movie are Shatner free climbing a mountain called the Captain.
Yeah.
True.
I love the opening sequence. I love the climbing. I love the music.
You love the rocket boots?
That music part is the music that goes.
Well, it's playing over credits. It's perfect if it's something.
It's great.
Playing over the credits like that. Yeah, I think it's great. And the music. Well, we'll go into Jerry Goldsmith's score later, but that piece of music that plays over the opening credits is one of my favorite pieces of Star Trek.
It is really good.
Oh, I'll have.
Yeah,
to
I was just re-listening to it.
Oh, I love
thinking
it.
About
it.
It is really
I love it.
Great.
Oh.
It's very helpful. Oh, I love it's it. Very fun. Yeah.
Can we talk about the rocket boots?
Let's talk about the rocket boots.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, the first big problem in the movie, the fucking rocket boots. Yeah,
why? Rocket boots. Why? Just why?
Oh.
It's so stupid. I don't even have anything more to say except for it's just incredibly stupid.
Somebody was sitting around thinking
stupid,
it would be
and
neat.
Then the stupid joke.
Yeah.
I don't think you realize the gravity of your situation.
Yeah.
See, I know, and it's just like, what am I watching?
I think the gravity boots were invented just for that joke. You know what I mean? Somebody was like,
it wouldn't surprise
you
me.
You know, it's like, oh, sitting around, how do we make this joke work? We'll give them rocket boots, you know? It's like, oh, God.
So stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, that's why I go back to saying Spock comes off as kind of dumb in this, because, like, he says, concentration is vital. You must be at one with the rock. And it's like, then stop distracting him.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's
I think
Spock's
that
fault
goes...
that Kirk falls.
Yeah.
It is.
It is basically. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And then there's a terrible rear projection effect.
Oh yeah, it looks really bad.
It's so bad. Mm-hmm. It's so bad. Before we move off of this whole section altogether, do we want to talk about Dr. McCoy at all?
Okay. I do want to say I love his camping ascot.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
And
his whole getup.
I love when they're just sitting.
He's got the whole Southern gentleman thing going.
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. I love when they're sitting there at dinner afterwards, and he says, "You know, Jim, you really piss me off, right?" Mm-hmm. You can tell he's been sitting on that for years. So I think DeForest Kelly does a great job with the material he's given.
He does, and that scene with him and his father.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I think is very good, and is like apparently at the time like. Took quite a bit out of DeForest Kelly. Like, he was pretty shaken up after he did the scene.
Yeah, and I mean, it's in a way, it was fairly controversial, because that's effectively showing / discussing euthanasia, like human euthanasia.
Yeah. Well, yes,
and that's something.
Right. Yes and no. I mean, I don't think euthanasia or doctor assisted suicide, I think, is a little different than just pulling the plug, right, and letting nature take its course.
No, you're right, but
yeah, you're right.
That was a hot button kind of thing in 89.
Yeah,
don't forget.
Dr. Kevorkian.
It was.
Kevorkian was right. in the news, and so this was kind of a big deal to say, in the future, it's not to say that it's no big deal, but that it's something that they just, they find it ethical and they do it,
Yeah. I do think it was a great character moment, though, because it does. You do find out why sometimes Leonard McCoy can be so abrasive. Mm-hmm. And it kind of opened up the character a little bit, I think. You kind of realize that he's carrying more baggage than we ever thought he was.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a great character moment myself.
I honestly don't think the scene worked that well for me.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe it's something about the way that they did it. I was already not really on board with the whole Cybok can just mind control people thing. And it was confusing to me when, like, all of a sudden he shows up in the room, and then I was like, well, can Kirk and Spock also see what's going on? Because, like, in previous times, so, like, the whole thing was like the inner logic of what was actually happening was confusing to me.
Okay.
And so it was hard for me to get past that. And then I just felt, I don't know. Maybe I'm just being cynical, but it just seems like a little it seems like a little obvious, maybe, or lazy to like, oh, let's build in this, you know, character building backstory moment where, you know, he had to make some, do some horrible thing, and this has been haunting him his whole life. It's like, I don't, it just, I don't buy that that affects him for the rest of the life, his life, the way that, like, the way you're saying, oh, maybe, like, that's why he's grumpy sometimes. I'm just like,
well, it's, well, it's, I think Sabah preys on that.
It's also unclear when it happened, right? Did this happen when he was a young doctor? Did this happen a year and a half ago?
I always got the impression it happened when he was a young doctor.
I did,
which
too.
Which is why it affected him so harshly, you know?
I got that impression as well, but it's a good point. We don't actually know for sure. But I was just, honestly, I was so confused by what was happening in the scene. I think that the rest of it didn't, it just kind of fell flat for me.
Yeah, you raised a good point. I don't remember. Do other people actually react to what's going on?
Yeah, I think like Kirk and Spock start to react to it.
See, that's even weirder.
But that's confusing.
In theory, it should be this like envisioning, like right for the audience of like what's going on
right
in his head, right?
But you can see them all like watching McCoy do this.
Yeah, it's very sort of, you
they're
know,
watching
theatrical.
McCoy. You don't know if they're actually watching what McCoy's doing. You've just seen them.
But
the other time
Spock, Sybok mind controlled people, you couldn't see what was happening. You couldn't see them reacting to things. They were
just
like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden my pain is gone. And in this case, like, you know, even if they couldn't see the visions that McCoy was having, they could see him reacting and walking over and talking, seemingly talking to himself.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but of course. Why wouldn't
they? Well, because in the other times, that never had happened before. Kayla's
totally
mind control
right.
People.
You're right. He just kind of walks up to him and goes, and Letic touches him, and they're like, oh, I feel so much better.
Like in the opening scene.
Right, in the opening.
Yeah, he mind controls the guy on the planet.
Yeah.
It just happens immediately.
Again, I think it's a lot of dramatic license. Like I was saying, I think somebody got, like, you know, kind of a theatrical production. Like, it's very stagey, you know, in their head. Like,
yeah, it is.
Ooh,
it is.
We're gonna come over, you know, go stage right a little bit and come down stage a little bit and show this. And it's
and
like,
then the
well,
light
yeah.
hits this hospital bed all of a sudden. Yeah.
It totally is. Somebody got, you know, their sort of theater, like, buff on when it's like we were saying, but it's film. You don't actually have to do theatrical tricks in film. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but there you go. They did. And I think it's simply to have the trio always watching each other. You know, like you know, it's like, mm-hmm. So I get it. But I also see why that's kind of weird and inconsistent.
And to be honest, I know you guys are concerned about how we've never seen Vulcans do what Sybok does. We've never seen Vulcans abuse their mental ability either.
Right.
Which is what Sybok is
doing.
See,
okay, but I have to say, though, it's more than just... I could accept, oh, he all of a sudden, right, has this ability because other Vulcans don't act like him. He's embraced his emotions. He's gone on a different path. So that I'm okay with, actually. It is, I guess, if you put it in the context of anything else, it's just like one more small point, you know, against the film. But I agree, it's not a big deal. But what I don't like about it is that it seems like a really lazy plot device. Because it's like, how are we going to get everyone to go along with Sybok? Oh, we'll just give him a magic power to make them go along with him immediately.
Yeah.
And there's like no effort on his part.
And that's very true. It's basically the MacGuffin of the movie.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
There's this episode of TNG called Gambit where the sort of golden fleece that they're trying to get is this Vulcan telepathic artifact. And I think if they'd given Sybok something like that... Because, like, the Vulcans are kind of telepathic, but he's not – they're never supposed to be, like, super villains, right? I mean, he's basically, you know, the X-Men villain Mesmero or whatever. And it's particularly – see, the thing I like about the secret pain business is it kind of reminds me of the episode The Naked Now, where the idea is the crew lose their cool and they lose their composure and we see what they're like inside. So it's kind of like that. The thing, and so I actually, even though maybe it's not direct, the scene's not directed very well, I do like the scene where we see what Bones' secret pain is or where Spock's is, what Spock's is. What bothers me is that we don't get any of that kind of insight for Sulu, Chekov, or Uhura, right? Who all get
right.
Well, that circles back to Shatner's ego.
Yeah.
They don't matter.
They don't. Or they don't get.
Well, when they did the conversion of them, they do it off camera.
They
like
do,
you see the camera push in on Sulu and Uhura,
and
then
they cut
away. So for all we know, it went through an elaborate thing. But
I know, but that would have been interesting to see to get a little bit more insight into any of these three characters.
That would have taken a lot of time, though. I mean, just thinking about the budgeting the film.
You can't do all that.
Which, to be fair, Maeve says before, the thing about an ensemble cast is it's great for a TV show is because then you can focus on two or three different characters a week and it's never the same. But it's really hard to cram them all into one movie and give them all the right amount of time. Which is one of the things that Final Frontier's predecessor, Voyage Home, does so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they all have something different to do.
Yeah, exactly. They'll have different little missions, the nuclear vessels and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, although they all technically have things to do in the Final Frontier also. I mean, Sulu goes on the assault team with Spock.
Yeah,
and Kirk.
And he gets the cool, crazy shuttle landing to do.
Yeah.
He does all that. Yeah, mm-hmm. He does that crazy shuttle landing. Chekhov plays, the Captain Chekhov thing. And Walter laid that on
thick. Did a great job with that.
Yeah, he had a grand old time doing that. And Nichelle did her stupid little fan dance thing.
Yeah, that was weird.
It is.
Cool. Also weird that they gave her
Loved doing that, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, you can imagine she would. Just because she used to be a dancer and she used to be an
entertainer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
she had a grand old time.
They also did the weird thing between Uhura and Scotty where they flirted for a little bit.
Huh? Yeah, they did.
Yeah, that was weird. Right,
that's weird.
That came out of
nowhere.
As if they were supposed to have been together already for some time.
Yeah.
And when I watched that the first time, I remember thinking, oh, I never realized that. I need to watch more episodes of the original series. To see the backstory
it's
of this relationship.
Yeah, it's nowhere. There's nothing for it.
Yeah.
No. There's way more foundation. Right after the voyage home, and there's nothing there indicating it either.
There's
right.
way more foundation for Uhura and Spock than there is,
true.
Than her and Scotty.
Okay, so. While we're talking about Cybok, our villain, is there anything else we want to say about him? Do we think another actor might have been able to pull this off better?
I think it's weird that they're thinking about Sean Connery for it. I have a really hard time picturing that.
I think that's delusional that he thought he could get Sean Connery.
Oh, yeah. They would never get him. let's be realistic.
Especially financially. There's no way.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think they for Gandalf, they wanted to get Sean Connery. They looked at that and you think, okay, yeah, they could have gotten him for that, but not for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Anyway, he wasn't available because he was doing Last Crusade.
Last Crusade.
Right. A far better movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a little.
Yeah.
Okay, in terms of the villains, is there anything we want to say about the sort of random Klingon menace? Captain Claw, I think
right.
his name is.
Oh, yeah. See, this whole thing almost doesn't even matter, right? I've forgotten all about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because all they do is, they shoot Pioneer 10 out of the sky.
Yeah, yeah, and when they do that, you can clearly hear a scream in the background.
Yes, and that is the weirdest thing. I'm glad you noted that. And I'm like, what is that? It's not living. It's a weird sound effect choice. Yeah, and then all they do is basically stalk Kirk because he's got kind of a weird, pre-TNG Klingon, honor boner on to, face down Kirk. And it's like, why? What?
Because Kirk is the best.
Did you know that Kirk is the best that ever was?
Yeah. And
this is a follow-up to the plot in The Voyage Home, though. Kirk is considered a renegade by the Klingon Empire.
Sure, but they don't
there
even really
be
touch
no
on
peace
that.
As long as Kirk lives. Go. They talk about that to some degree. There's a certain... It's in there. He's supposed to be the renegade James... The renegade James T. Kirk.
They could
in The Voyage Home, they say that. They say nothing to that effect in The Final Frontier.
Well, they just sort of... I think they
follow up on it.
So I guess in that way the continuity does make sense.
I don't know. Anyway, I don't think it's a very good continuation, let's say. I think it's just... It seems very random. It's like this random Klingon decides he should do it. Who is he? Why do we care?
He's not particularly well-developed. The one thing I do want to say is I love the turret he has that comes down for him to be the gunner.
It looks very submarine, and
it's very vain. I'm the captain. I'm the one who gets to shoot stuff.
I really like the production
design on that.
Well, and then, of course, the bonus of that is they give that to Chang in the next movie.
Yeah.
Which is really, really comes together.
I thought you were going to say the bonus of that is when we see that Spock is the gunner later on to shoot the
Oh, God that's monster, a great, that's
which
a great
is a good reveal.
Too,
but... That's a good little moment right there.
Mm.
Yes, it is.
I just want to circle back to Cybok really quickly because we really didn't talk about, Lawrence Luckinbill at all.
Okay.
No, you're right. Let's talk about him.
I just wanted to say that for the role, I thought he actually did a good job. I mean, yeah, would it have been better to have somebody with a little more star power? Sure. But I felt like he held the role very well.
I think we've talked about this, and other people have mentioned it before, just, well, throughout Trek history, is I think it's actually good that we don't give someone with star power these kinds of roles, because then it gets really, it just gets really distracting, right? Because say mm-hmm. for example, if it was Sean Connery, all you would see is Sean Connery. Like, you wouldn't see this new this character, right? You'd be like, why is old James Bond being weird and you know, mind melting people?
I don't know.
At least I think
so. I don't know. When I watch Last Crusade, I don't see an old James Bond. I see Henry Jones.
No, I mean, I was being facetious with that, but you know what I mean. Like, you see Sean Connery, you know?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
And I think he fits better.
Or he might have disappeared into the role. Who knows?
Yeah. You know? True. Who knows?
Anyway, I thought Luckinbill did a nice job with the role.
Yeah, I think it was a role where it could have been screwed up really bad, right? I mean, like Shatner said, one of his inspirations for this was like the 1980s type of televangelist. And if Luckinbill had played the character mm-hmm. as like a Saturday Night Live-esque parody of that, it would have been completely unwatchable. And so the fact that he plays it, like I said, the earnestness is the word that I keep coming back to. The fact that he plays it so earnestly, I think, really embiggens the role.
You know what's really funny? Here's a connection to another movie from 1989 that you just like clicked with me. It's apparently a televangelist thing, and like, yes, okay, I knew that, but like, thinking about it, yeah, the televangelist thing was really big. You know, another 1989 movie involves a fake televangelist, and it's really weird. It's a really weird thing. Is the James Bond movie License to Kill, in fact, has one of those in
really
it. Yep, he's a front for drug money down in Mexico. Played by Wayne Newton.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yep. I completely forgot about
that. Yeah, right. It's so weird. But that's also from 1989. So apparently this was like, I mean, I know that was actually like a thing in the news at the time, but boy, was this in like the public psyche then.
Interesting.
Because
yeah, Jim Baker and all that stuff. Yeah. That was all happening.
That was all going on.
Like Jared said, Shatner openly admits that was the inspiration.
Yeah.
And that's why Cybok has the power that he has to marshal people. That was Shatner's inspiration. That Cybok is kind of just, you know. So.
Yeah.
Anything else on Cybok? Do we want to talk about anything more about the long lost brother stuff? Maybe the character design. Does the character look the way he should?
Yeah, I think he looks fine. And like you said, he's played so earnestly, also that. You kind of feel an empathy for Cybok. I don't dislike Cybok.
Well, especially by the end when everything's sort of dashed for him and you can see it and you can kind of feel it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
There's a weird moment where you can clearly see in between when they're on the Enterprise and everything's happened before then and when they get to the God Planet, where Cybok has cut his hair because he goes from having this long kind of, you know,
I remember that.
Prophet in the desert type of hair to just having a normal haircut. And it's really
well,
sudden.
You know, When you go to see God, you gotta get a shave and haircut,
guess,
right?
I guess so.
Yeah, you gotta look your best, man. Cybok put on his Sunday best.
Okay, do we want to say anything about the three ambassadors on Nimbus 3?
Yeah, this whole thing is weird too. And another thing that makes it feel very much outside of the rest of the movies is where was this silly idea from, and where did this come from, and like. Why does this planet exist, and why does anybody think this is actually a good idea? And even weirder is, why does it devolve into like kind of 20th century Mad Max-y stuff?
Yeah,
yeah. Like that doesn't make any sense either. Like, why would it suddenly turn into, you know, scrounging people in the desert?
I just don't get it.
You know?
I think the idea is the only people they could con into coming to this planet were people who were pretty much on their last leg anyway, so it wasn't exactly the
never-do-wells.
Yeah,
sure, but then that means A, we have a serious like resource problem somewhere in the Federation, which doesn't exactly fit. That's more of a 24th century thing, I realize, but even still, like, we don't really get that hint of it in the 23rd century. Well, the TOS movies, I should say. We do hear about scarcity in TOS itself sometimes. But yeah, it's just very out of place that, like, apparently there's people with this kind of scarcity and, you know, problems that they would just pick up and move to a very crappy planet, honestly.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm not bothered by the planet itself at all, to be honest. Sort of happy to accept that a place like that would exist in the Federation. But I think Jared mentioned the three ambassadors. I have no idea what their role was.
Why do they need to stay?
Why were they meeting?
Yeah.
What was the point of those characters at all? And what was the point of like, why did Cybok choose this planet and to capture these people in order to lure Kirk? That didn't follow any logical progression. The only reason Kirk got sent out there, which he wasn't, it's not like he was nearer the area or was scheduled to be patrolling that area or anything. You know, they just said, Kirk, we need to pick up a gallon of milk for the Federation, and you're the only one in the sector.
It's the classic movie paradox that they always put the Enterprise in. You're the only one that can do it.
He's like, our ship doesn't work, and they're like, too bad, go anyway.
Okay, there's a moment in there that I really like, though, is when Harv Bennett or Admiral Bennett is giving him the assignment. And he says, you're the only one who can do it. They want Jim Kirk. And you can hear Kirk says kind of under his breath, oh, please. Right?
He does. It's awesome.
He's making fun of the cliche that they're using. And so I really like that little moment.
Yeah,
because it doesn't make any sense to send a ship that's failing with the captain who the Klingons are going to attack on site. Anyway, what were you saying, Brian?
Right.
Yeah. No, just going back to the three ambassadors and why Cybok clearly was tipped off that the three of them were going to be meeting, because he deliberately goes after them particularly.
Yes.
He says this is the only place in the galaxy that contains the three of you. He basically wanted a Federation, a Klingon, and a Romulan ship to show up at Nimbus 3, so he could figure one of them will get him. He can get on one of their ships, do his thing, and get to Shakari. Yeah.
Right.
So it's actually not a terrible plan.
That's what he. That was the whole point.
I don't know why he needed all three of them.
I think he's just casting as wide a net.
I
would have.
I think he's just going for the odds. Yeah. Okay. Just one of them is going
to
show up.
That made total sense to me.
However, he's also playing the odds that the Klingons and the Romulans wouldn't just kill him on sight.
Yes, and of course they would. Yeah. That's the funny part. Yeah. They totally would.
I will say, I do love the Romulan ambassador in this. I love how cheerful and optimistic she is. And we usually...
You know, that's because she was a newscaster, right? In real life.
Oh, the actress was? Oh, great.
Yeah, she was like an LA newscaster by trade, originally.
Yeah, I just...
I did not know that.
It's like Romulans are supposed to be arrogant, and she combines this arrogance with like this winsome optimism. She's like, I guess I've arrived just in time. Like, this planet is terrible, but I'm going to fix it. So...
That is true.
I really like her inclusion. You can tell she's enjoying hamming it up a little bit.
I just wanted to say there were a lot more scenes shot with all three of those people that were kind of.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I don't quite know why.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff out there.
Matt,
do you know anything about that?
No, actually, I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. David Warner has said that a lot of his work ended up on the cutting room floor.
Interesting.
I think that the maybe one of the reasons that got cut out is, like I said earlier, there's just so much. So many characters who are fighting for screen time that it's difficult to give that much time to a villain and then three other minor characters as well, in addition to our cast of seven.
Yeah.
So let's use that as a segue to talk about our supporting cast. We've got Walter, George, Nichelle, and of course Jimmy. How do they fare in this?
It's on evens, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Jimmy has some fun moments. He has some really bad moments. Walking into that stupid beam.
Oh my god! I forgot.
Like that's terrible.
That's the low point. That's the low point of the movie.
Here's a guy who, in his free time, we've seen studies tech specs in his free time. Mm-hmm. Right, he's overseeing them. It's kind of finishing the refit that wasn't finished on this whatever they rushed out and renamed Enterprise A at the end of the voyage home, right? Because the implication is they rushed a refit of some other ship out,
right,
and renamed it Enterprise A for them, right? So they picked that up, they picked that sort of unspoken theme up, because they don't directly say that, but at the beginning of The Final Frontier, and there he is, trying to finish the refit of like the transporter systems and yada yada, and it's like, all right, but he's a really capable guy, and if he's in here like in the guts of the ship, Yeah, he's not going to be like, oh, I know this ship like the back of my hand, and then turn around and whack himself in the head. It's just not going to happen.
It's also, you know?
That's
that,
not who he is.
That very broad moment of stupid physical comedy comes just like 3 minutes after we saw a son euthanize his father, right?
So, oh, true.
Totally.
Yeah,
it is
that's not funny.
Completely off.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, Kayla, what were you going to say?
Good point. It wasn't. But that was right after they broke him out of the brig.
Oh, was it? Okay. Well, it's, I guess it's before then. But it's weird to have those two
it's,
elements.
It's in a row, right, basically. All these things happen in a row. Yeah. It's like...
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, he also has one of the better lines in the movie when he busts him out. And he goes, what are you all standing around for? Do you not know jailbreaking yourself?
That, and that's a great
one. That is a good moment. Yeah. And the whole idea of using the Morse code is... That's very Star Trek-y, is like low-tech solutions often are needed in our high-tech world. I also love the line Scotty has where he says, we'll beat those Klingon devils even if I have to get out and push. It's just a very Scotty line. So I think he's handled pretty well.
I was about to say Scotty did probably fared as one of the best of the so-called supporting characters, except for when you brought up that moment of when he walks into the beam. I was just like, oh, wow. That I forgot that had happened. That was so stupid. And like I think like Matt's whole explanation is great, except for that. I don't think you even need to say that. It doesn't matter. Nothing about his character matters. The fact that they put that gag in there is what is so stupid. Just the gag itself is stupid, regardless of the character and everything. That's just that stuff's just bonus.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. How does Uhura do in this? You mentioned the fan dance. Is there anything else you want to say about that or her performance or contribution?
That was like her main role.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's about all she gets to do. That's really too bad.
Yeah, that was.
And she like brought Scotty a sandwich.
That's true.
And they flirt, and that's weird. And there you go. in the silver like space food packaging too.
I like that.
That's kind of awesome in the 80s.
It was like, what do they have in there? Like Chex Mix?
I think it's supposed to be like astronaut ice cream.
It looked absolutely terrible.
Astronaut food.
It's like,
yeah.
It's like it looked terrible.
That's a very 80s thing to do too, because you know, space camp was a really huge thing for kids to do, and so it's totally like the freeze dried astronaut food that she hands them.
Yeah, it totally is. Let's see who else. George did okay, like we were saying. You know, George, you know, was on the assault team that went down to the planet, and
and that's his big moment. And then he just kind of fades
away. He's in the big action sequence. Yeah.
There's a moment there where they're on the bridge, and Kirk just reaches up and grabs Sulu by the shoulder and says, "Let's go." That's very there's a lot of camaraderie in that moment right there, where it's like they've, you know, this is old hat for them. They save galaxies every week, right? And I like seeing that kind of brotherliness between the two of them, which is why it's sometimes, you know, it bugs me that in real life to know they're not friends, but I do like that little moment. And I like the way, you know, when he's in the action scene, like they shine the light and he says, "Sulu, go," and like he does some kind of roll and shoots the light out. And I do think like the phaser shots in Final Frontier look beautiful, right? The way there's a little kind of glow effect when they hit people. I also like that the security guys are carrying shields, right? Like they live in a world where disruptor beams can vaporize you. It's like maybe they'd have some kind of defense. And so I like that tactically they're innovating a little bit. And I like that they have like their desert camos that they go in and
yeah, George
looks great.
The desert thing is smart.
So there's some good stuff there.
And by the way, little aside, so people who think that there's no tactical gear except for Discovery. Hello, the Final Frontier.
Exactly.
There's tactical gear.
It's one of those things where because it doesn't have as much of a legacy, like even good stuff from it is not going to be carried on. I mean, as far as I know, this Final Frontier is never mentioned. Nothing from it is ever mentioned ever again, right? None of the costumes. None of the names of planets or whatever we hear.
No, the really cool phasers they made for this movie carry on at least.
Oh, do they?
I really like the phasers.
Yeah,
that, they use them in Star Trek.
They use them
6.
In the Undiscovered Country.
These assault phasers look kick ass. I love them. Huh. Like I think they're awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, the phasers are cool. I have to disagree with you though about how the lasers beams looked. I thought they looked really smart.
Oh really?
Oh really?
Yeah, huh. I didn't think they were, like, most of the visual effects in this movie, I thought they were terrible.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because we know Shatner was really into the prop side of it. I mean, he's the reason why they didn't just carry over the otherwise very nice. Like, I really like the Star Trek 3 version of the phaser. That's very reminiscent of the TOS one, but with kind of very, like, 80s angles on it. I like that one a lot, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it a lot. That's one of my second sort of favorite, like, movie phasers because of that. But one of the reasons why they didn't just carry those over, you know, pull them out of the prop storage, was the Shat wanted something cool. And he wanted the, like, the power packs you snap in the bottom, kind of like loading a cartridge. He wanted that. So he literally came to the prop guys and said, no. I want something cool that everyone looks like an action hero with. And he made them invent this new, you know, model for it. So it's funny that you think the phasers are kind of like the visual effects that is sloppy. You'd think that'd be like the one thing he'd pay attention to because he was really into it, you know?
Well,
but
we can go into a discussion about the visual effects in the movie, and we should.
Yeah. As we know, they didn't work out quite the way anyone hoped.
All right. So we've kind of been talking around it, but we need to mention the villains and everything and the theme of the movie. Let's get into how the quote-unquote God character works. We finally meet him. Captain Kirk, in his greatest adventure, not only finds God, but he beats him in a fight. How does this work, Brian? Is this appropriate? Is this fitting in a long line of Kirk successfully defeating God-like beings? Or does it fall flat on its face?
It's kind of goofy. But because of the way it's presented, it is amusing in its own way. I mean, everybody loves to quote that line, you know, what does God need with a starship?
Yeah, that I moment mean, lands.
It comes across, it totally does, and then McCoy comes over and goes, Jim, you don't ask the Almighty for his ID.
Yeah.
I mean, it's goofy. Like, it worked, yeah, but that's the thing. Like, it's a stupid idea that kind of gets redeemed by the verve and the way the cast kind of plays it off, but it doesn't work. You got this basically Kirk and Spock and McCoy are talking to a giant head.
Yeah. But they sell it, man. The Shat sells it. Little finger, index totally finger in the air. It. Excuse me. You know, that's great.
Yeah, excuse me. What does, don't you know me? Aren't you God?
Yeah.
I think Shatner does great in the scene, but I was pretty shocked that McCoy was so easily convinced. Like, he's a smart dude. And
he's very cynical, so he shouldn't be into it.
Yeah, and as far as I can tell,
somebody's got to be the audience.
I guess so.
But somebody has to be the audience there.
But as far,
and it's got, and typically McCoy is the audience in most of these movies.
As far as I can tell, most of the Enterprise crew are rather, you know, secular.
Yeah.
So why I don't get why, like, I don't understand how the religion thing fits in. I think, Brian, at the beginning of the podcast, you started to mention, you know, what this film is about and that it says some things about religion and belief systems. And I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on that, honestly, because for me, it was really all over the place. I'm not sure what they were trying to say about religion or belief systems.
Ultimately, I think, and Kirk says it at the end of the movie, he goes, maybe God isn't out there. Maybe God is in here in the human heart. I think at the end, even though it's not presented very well throughout the movie, in fact, it's barely presented at all, I think that's what he's trying to say, that we make our own.
Yeah, no, that's what he's,
our own beliefs.
That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah, that definitely is where it
lands. But it doesn't work.
It's done in a very clumsy way.
Although that scene is very nice otherwise. That's a very nice trio scene when they're talking, having that heart-to-heart.
But yeah, the whole thing presenting God. I mean, was anybody surprised that the Enterprise crew did not find God?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course it couldn't.
That was the argument. That was the argument that Harv Bennett made to Shatner when Shatner pitched him the story. He goes, Bill, this is what's going to happen 2 or 3 years from now. Somebody's going to read the summary for this movie in the TV guide where it's going to say, the Enterprise goes in search of God. And the person who reads that is going to go, well, that's freaking stupid.
Trash.
You're never going to meet God.
Yeah,
it's so stupid. It's never going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's the suspense at the end of the movie really isn't there because you know there's no way in hell they were going to show some sort of manifestation of a supreme being. There was no way that was going to happen.
No.
So there's nothing was shocking about the fact that this person purporting to be God was actually, in a way, the devil.
Sure.
Sure.
Or not even, just an alien. So, he's just some alien.
Right. but an evil, deeply evil animal.
Right, but it's like, right. How, like, it's been there, done that. That story's been told a million times.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right, exactly. So it was stupid. It was stupid. It was stupid.
Yeah, it was sloppy. Just very sloppy.
I just want to save that clip of Brian saying, it was stupid. It was stupid. And every time I'm going to think I'm going to go watch The Final Frontier, I'm just going to play that.
Yeah, yeah. Save it as an MP3.
Do you think of watching it often? I don't.
No, good point.
Okay, the other problem is this godlike being, regardless of whether it's the actual creator of the universe or the actual devil or whatever, is going up against the long list of other godlike beings in the Star Trek universe, and he doesn't really hold a candle. I mean, this is in the Star Trek canon, we'd already met and fallen in love with John Delancey as Q. Even when we hated him, we still loved him. And so
AKA
this guy's like,
Trelane part two.
Sure. We've already got Trelane as well.
Yeah, Trelane.
Apollo.
We met Apollo. That's right. And of course, in the animated series, we did meet the actual devil in the Magic of Vegas 2.
Lucian.
Friend Kirk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
He's treading in some footprints that have already been made and not enhancing them in any way, shape, or form.
Good point, Jared.
Very weak.
We do have to mention the actor who plays God would later play Admiral JP on Best of Both Worlds Part 1.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's so weird. That's right.
George Murdoch.
Yeah, George Murdoch.
Yep, George. He played Dr. Selleck in the original Battlestar Galactica.
That's right.
He was in a lot of shows over the years.
There was a Battlestar connection there.
He had a great voice.
I just saw younger him on Ironside over the weekend, too. That's how long that guy's been in the business.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I will say the one spiritual moment that I do like in the movie is when Kirk says, I've always known that when I die, I'll die alone. And Bones says, well, we'll call Valhalla and have them reserve a room.
Oh, yeah.
That's a cute... That's a cute little moment there. And, you know, if you think about it, when Kirk, quote-unquote, dies in the beginning of Generations, he is all alone in that scene. So they did actually continue that. They kept that thread alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he actually dies, he's there with Picard. But when the crew of the Enterprise A thinks he dies, he is alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as I'm concerned, that's when he really died anyway.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, the other thing we have to mention about the God planet and everything is the center, and I did a little research on this ahead of time. The center of the galaxy is about 25,000 light years from the planet Earth, which, as we see in Voyager, right, when Voyager gets sent to the other side of the galaxy, that would take years and years to get there. Maybe, and with the lesser technology of the 23rd century, it would have taken decades. So there's kind of a huge continuity error there that they're able to do it in a matter of minutes. I don't know if that bothers anyone, but it definitely stands out as something that's not fitting.
Unfortunately, the precedent for this was already set back in Where No Man Has Gone Before in the pilot, where somehow they get to the same barrier in about the same amount of time, remember? So this is already like bad TOS science made worse, basically.
Well, no, when No Man Has Gone Before, they were already near the edge of the galaxy when the episode opens.
Yeah.
Fair enough. There. But either way.
The other thing is, as a disc, I mean, the galaxy has a lot of different edges, right? But it's only because you could leave it at any point. But there's only one center. But you're
right, and in When No Man Has Gone Before, they're at the edge of the Milky Way. In Star Trek V, they're trying to get to the center of it, aren't they?
Wait, did I just confuse myself? I thought that was they're trying to get to the same place.
No, it's similar because there's the barrier. They talk about the barrier because I think they
talk about a barrier,
and it's called the Great Barrier, right? Yes. And so I think in the TOS episodes, they have either the same or very similar name for the barrier at the edge of the universe.
They do. So anyway,
The galaxy. Excuse me.
I just lost my TOS cred for the week.
No, it's an easy... Because I thought the same thing. I thought back to that episode when I was watching it
because
as well.
Because they talk about barriers and you know, edges of galaxies or inside, you know, centers of galaxies.
Impermeable barrier.
And, and then Kirk has to beat up a godlike being. So they're continuing.
Oh, true. There
right.
you go.
Along,
it's just a shitty remake of Where No Man's Gone Before.
It is.
That's what it is.
Exactly.
Well, a lot of people would say that this was actually just a bad... third season episode of the
it is.
Yeah.
Jared, do they actually say that it's 25,000 light years from Earth?
No, that's that's
because I was gonna say that's the actual distance.
Yeah, that no, they never say it. I looked it up on the internet.
Okay,
yeah, they don't mention distances. No,
no.
So if anything, then Voyager is incorrect. If it's true that in Voyager they could actually, oh sorry, I was getting confused. Actually, never mind. You're right.
Yeah.
The distance, the it's the speed that's inconsistent, not the distance.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so there's no way they'd be able to make that trip. Unless they do like a nth degree Reginald Barclay thing where the godlike being feeds information into his brain to allow him to create a wormhole. But they didn't do any of that.
No, that would have made too much sense for this movie.
Yeah.
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 Okay, so another continuity issue I want to raise is at the end of the movie, Spock's like, oh, I lost a brother, and Kirk says, I lost a brother once, I was lucky to get him back. And it's like, wait, Kirk, you know, you had an actual brother and he was murdered by alien bat parasites.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're not going to go into that, though.
No,
yeah.
No, but it's like
such an asshole thing to do, like totally forgot about his real brother.
Yeah, his actual brother who was killed. And Bill even played him, right? In the little shot in the teaser for Operation Annihilate. Anyway, so that's
George Samuel Kirk.
There you go. Who came back?
But of course, the theme of this whole movie is the sort of family of these three guys. So, you know, there you go.
That's true.
It works.
You can understand what he's going for there. He's trying to say, "You're my friend, and I'm glad that you're alive." And we're remembering a much better movie from several years ago.
Yes.
Now, have you guys read this that Roddenberry considered Star Trek V to be non-canonical? Is there?
Oh yeah, he came out. He came out right away and said that, like instantly. Behind the scenes, he hated this script, and as you know, at this point, he had nothing but a figurehead over the TOS movies. He was just a credit. He hated it.
Yeah, well, Gene hated it for two reasons. One, first of all, obviously, it was a shitty script. Mm-hmm. And two, Gene had tried to get a movie that talked about God made in the mid-70s doing Star Trek called The God Thing.
Oh.
And Paramount, I remember being a thing like Barry Diller, who was running the studio at the time, was just like, he's like, we can't make this movie. He was like questioning the nature of God. Like, it was like very direct and blunt. And it was simply not going to get made. It had elements of it that were later brought into the motion picture, but it was basically dismissed out of hand. You know, the Bible Belt would lose their minds if we made this movie. We're not making this movie. So Gene had to go back and figure out something else. So he was pissed that Shatner got to make a movie that discussed religious themes and he didn't get to. So there was an element of that going on, too.
Some jealousy.
So, yeah, but I agree with Gene that the movie should be ruled non-canonical. It's a hot mess.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be difficult to argue the other side of that.
I don't remember if this is like legit or if this is maybe his sort of public version, because as you said, Brian, really he's kind of ticked that this theme, you know, of a movie he already tried and was shot down for. But I remember him also, I believe, saying that he didn't approve of the Cybok angle either, that he was a step, half-brother kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, in terms of continuity, do you think they will mention Cybok on Discovery at all?
No. They're going to pretend that never existed, I think.
Ah, interesting.
No, but they could.
That's interesting.
Right?
But good point.
They could.
And who knows? They might. They might drop it.
He's technically Lieutenant Burnham's or Commander Burnham's half-brother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, could maybe. Well, that'll be something interesting to look into. See if they actually go there. Yeah.
But the idea would be that he's already probably a young person and probably long left at some point. So who knows?
Yeah, but they might still mention him.
Yeah, they could name drop him.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see if
they
did.
Interesting. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
My vote would be that they ignore it, but we'll see.
Yeah, probably. They probably will, but it's worth speculating about that, for sure.
Cybok is certainly no Harry Mudd in terms of fan favorites we'd like to see back, but he's a character. Somebody might say we can do something a little more creative with this, so we'll see what happens. Okay, in terms of continuity, let's move from continuity into talking about some of the effects and some of the production here. Brian, I know you have some strong opinions about this. How do the effects work?
They are atrocious. They are so amateur. Almost all the effects in this movie, with the exception of maybe one or two, are just amateurishly mounted. The effects were done by a company called Bran Farren and Associates. Bran Farren is a talented guy, but he was mostly known for doing mechanical type effects, and I think he ended up working for Imagineering for Disney after Star Trek V. But his company, while they had done film work before, they had not done anything remotely at the scale of a Star Trek film. And they were in way over their heads. And they were like the third option, I think, for the film crew going in. Because originally they wanted ILM to do it, but ILM got tied up with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and then Ghostbusters 2. So they were going to get like the third string team, but they still wanted like, you know, first string money ILM. Mm-hmm. So the production was like, well, we're not going to do that then. So they started looking for alternatives. And why they couldn't find any other effects shop in Hollywood to do it, I have no idea. But they ended up coming to New Jersey to this guy's warehouse, and he basically did this demonstration for like Shatner, Harve Bennett, and Ralph Winter. And like he did a couple of quick things, and the three of them were there like, oh, wow, that was really good. And they hired him, not knowing whether he was capable of actually pulling off a film of that scale or not. So I don't know about you guys, but most of the effects in the movie look amateurish to me.
I had no idea about that story. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Most of them, are not top notch, yes.
I mean, like, that scene when they're going in the shuttlecraft toward the Enterprise when they're looking out the window, and, you know, the music swells and you see the Enterprise against the moon. I mean, they look like somebody draped a model over in somebody's, like, garage.
I think they did. I think they did, Brian. Oh, my God. I think they did, man.
Holy shit. It was so bad.
Yeah.
It was so bad.
I've actually seen really great CGI composites, you know, fan done things of that moment, and it looks really good. But you know what I mean? If somebody were to really take care of it, it's a really nice scene. But you're right. It's totally a model hanging in front of somebody's, like, little backlit moon, like, translate, you know, of a moon. It's like, okay.
Yeah, great. I mean, so many of the effects look bad, and, like, just, like, the way the models move, and like there's very little layering in a lot of the shots. It's like very basic presentation. There's not a lot of dynamic movement or anything. It's just very amateurish and sloppy. The film company, the effects company, was in way over their heads.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
What do you think of the way the barrier itself looks?
The barrier actually doesn't, parts of it look okay. When you first see it on the screen, when it's like an energy thing, it looks cool.
Yeah.
When you get closer to it, though, it looks like they I don't know what the hell they did, like some sort of liquid process it looked like.
Oh, maybe, yeah. Like, I'm sure it was, you know, some kind of oil suspension and some stuff in it, and they spun it around and filmed it and all that kind of jazz.
And and then they show the Enterprise, like, moving toward it and going through it, and, like, it looks like they just kind of, like, did this, like, It looked like an effect straight out of the original series.
Yeah.
Where, like, they kind of just, like,
shrunk
the model optically to make it look like it was going through the barrier when it really wasn't going anywhere. It looked terrible.
Hmm.
Like, and then, like, even the god figure. I mean, that is literally a giant head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's TOS level stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty awful. Because Star Trek V actually is one of the most, with the exception of the motion picture, is one of the most expensive Star Trek movies with the original cast.
Yeah. I think that's because of their salary, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, parts of the movie look impressive. I mean, if you want to move off the visual effects, I mean, I don't know what do you guys think of the visual effects? Did it bother you, or is it something I'm hung up on?
I will say I actually like the way the barrier looks. But it does feel like the special effects belong to an earlier time. They don't look right for late 80s type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that rear projection when Kirk is falling off the mountain,
that's just awful.
That's straight up 60s TV. That's what they would do then. Yeah. Modern motion picture.
Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a major studio film. I mean, granted, Star Trek never had big budgets. Most of the Star Trek movies didn't have big budgets, but, like, they had enough money to do something better than that. I mean, my God.
Yeah, that means they didn't even have the effects. Well, that goes back to the effects house, right? Like, you probably couldn't tell those guys, oh, by the way, you need to rotoscope out Kirk in front of something. They'd be like, I can't do that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, these days, rotoscoping, although still a laborious thing, is so much easier digitally than it would have been to do that optically, right? And so, you know, Oh my god. So you can just imagine these poor guys in their Jersey garage being like, nope, we're gonna shoot it, you know, back projected, screw it. Like, we can't do it.
I felt bad for Shatner because, you know, guys like Ralph Winter, who was one of the producers in the film, it was his responsibility to make sure those guys did their jobs properly. Yeah. And Ralph basically failed. He failed.
Yeah.
And Shatner took the brunt of it because the people who were around him that was supposed to help him make the movie better failed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about like the sets and whatnot? Do you think the sets and the costumes look okay? Or did they suffer from the same fate as the special effects?
At least for me, I they had to redesign the Enterprise Bridge because the set had gotten damaged in between 4 and 5. It got water damage.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
That's why the bridge looks so different. And like Herman Zimmerman didn't have it was not in the budget to be building a new Enterprise Bridge set. So that thing was put together very quickly by Herman Zimmerman. And to me, it looks like shit.
I happen to like it, and I think it didn't look that terrible. I know that they strung it together very quickly in a budget, but I actually thought it looked fine. Like, I had no objections to it. And they basically used that same bridge with some tweaks and some rebuild for, Star Trek VI, and I liked it there a lot.
So. It looked much better in Star Trek VI. Yeah. They redressed it extensively.
Yes. Yeah, it got a good Meyer redressing, I will say. That.
Yeah, it looked much better.
It's very, the sets are very TNG to me. The corridors look like Enterprise D.
Well, and of course, that's what happens when you borrow from everybody, right? Because this is one of those things that I wanted to point out, because people were saying, oh, it looks like TNG. Yes, but remember, TNG is borrowing from like the original TMP sets to begin with. So we have this weird kind of back and forth of like, well, we kind of refurbished them to look 24th century, but now we're going to shoot a 23rd century movie. So they go back and forth and kind of, you know, change the little details a little bit, or, you know, quickly repaint something. But really, like, a whole lot of that stuff is exactly the way it was, with tweaks from the motion picture.
I think that part of the problem is that the sets in this movie date themselves the way that TNG sets date themselves. It's very much, they're very much a product of the time in which the movie was made.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, and they're very Herman Zimmerman.
Yes, they are very Herman Zimmerman. Yeah, the new bridge, as you were saying, the new bridge very much is some kind of is a bridge between like sort of the older TOS movie aesthetic and what TNG would look like. Bother me, because I think it's a nice evolution. I actually like that. But
as Caleb points out, I mean, there's some shots where they're just running down Enterprise D decks, right?
I think they at least tried to cover up the stickers that look like
the corridors, though, are like
they're
the TNG corridors.
Yep, they are.
But remember, those were the TMP corridors before it. So I mean,
yeah, those are the motion picture corridors.
What can you do?
The TNG corridors redressed as the motion.
That's the hard part, right? Yeah, you can't really do much with that at that point. But yes, you're right.
A great deal of the Enterprise D is simply motion picture sets redressed. Right. Engineering.
Right.
Sick bay.
Yeah. I mean, that's the hard part.
A lot of the corridors are all from the motion
picture. So you say that, right. So it's sort of a critique, but it's not really. Like, that's just life. Like, that's what they are. They're both. They're both the Enterprise D and the Reef Enterprise, you know? So.
Yeah, Paramount believed in stretching their Star Trek dollar as far as they possibly could.
Yeah.
Good for them. Matt, there was something you wanted to say about how many decks the Enterprise has.
Oh, well, this is one of those ones that bothers a lot of people. And again, with another goofy excuse to use the rocket boots, when they're escaping and they're climbing up, you know, the old, like a turbo shaft, I guess, that's out of commission, though they don't really talk about that. But they come up so many decks. It's a ridiculous amount of decks. Somebody just thought it was hilarious to put tons and tons of decks in this Enterprise. And of course, with the rocket boots, they shoot up to, you know, was it deck 78 or something?
Yep.
Oh, and my God.
Some crazy thing.
Utterly ridiculous.
And how many decks does the Enterprise have?
Right. Like 25.
25. Yeah. It's utterly ridiculous, but whatever. There you go. It's another rocket boot gag. Like,
I know. When he got those boots out again, I was like, Spock, no. Don't do it.
The other question is,
ate too many marshmallows.
Where were they for him to go get?
That right? Too, right?
Yes, because they start climbing and then he just
disappears.
Out
yeah. And like they could have just if he could sneak exactly. around the ship so easily to get his rocket boots, they probably didn't have then to climb up the ladder
that.
Thing.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. They could have just done that the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they're too heavy, but then they're not. And then I don't know. It's so stupid.
Well, he kicks in the turbo, you know.
Whatever. Well, there's also some continuity gaps where they pass the same the way it's edited, they pass the same deck more than once.
Oh like, yeah, sloppy stuff. Yeah.
You could say that's a throwback to that's an homage to TAS reusing the same shot over and over again.
Yes.
There you go.
That one crew member who had a different colored arm.
Yes.
Yeah. Or that one time Scotty had a mustache.
Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
So I had a question for you guys, and it's kind of about the role of Shatner as director of this film. And it's what I found myself asking while I was watching the film is how much control did Shatner have over certain little things? And I just want to bring up this one moment because I laughed so hard when I saw it and I wanted to make sure I talked about it on this podcast. Is there's a moment when they get to the God planet and it's the trio standing in that room with the like ship's wheel thing, I believe. And they're looking out a window and then it shows it goes back to the trio and, you know, Kirk says something and it pans down to a plaque that says like, what does it say?
To where no man has gone before.
Or it just says where no man has gone before. Yeah. And like the music swells and it's like, dun, 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 dun. You know, one of those moments. And it was just like the lamest thing. I'm sorry. It was just the lamest thing I've ever seen. And I'm just thinking like, did Shatner do this? Because this seems like a thing that Shatner thought was like a great idea.
He totally
idea.
Was like, put that plaque there.
He was like, we're going to, it was like so, like just hitting you over the head with it. Like where no man has gone before. Like this is
okay,
Star
so
Trek, you guys.
I ate that up as a
seven. Oh, it was so bad. But like,
I'm
curious though. And that, I mean, so there's a bunch of moments like that and different things throughout the whole film. So my question for you guys then is how much control did Shatner have over things like that or over the production as a whole being director?
Total.
I think he had a lot. He was the star, the director, the writer, and I think does he even have producer credit?
No. No, he didn't. Okay. But he is a writer and directing credit.
So I think he was the large and in charge.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, totally. Absolutely.
I think so too. Yeah.
Completely. He actually shot a good movie. Like he shoots well. He moves the camera well. He composes shots in an interesting way. He's a far more visually interesting director than Leonard Nimoy ever was.
Oh, interesting.
Leonard was very much a point-and-shoot kind of a director. He didn't... There was not a lot of movement of his camera, in my opinion. And, like, his composition was fine, but I didn't find it to be particularly compelling. Shatner actually tries to do a lot of cool things during the action sequences. There's a bunch of cool things at the beginning with Cybok. That he does. There's some cool stuff. He fails in other areas of the movie, obviously. He didn't get the performances he should have gotten in certain instances, and obviously the production design is like kind of all over the place. It goes from being very expensive looking to very cheap looking. Like there's like certain things that he did not do well, but from an actual shooting of a film, I think he did a really nice job.
You know, you mentioned that the scene that I think is shot really well is the sort of terrorist demand video. Where it's got the three ambassadors making their demands, and then it cuts to Cybok, and he's like walking very purposefully toward the camera, and like it makes no sense for the terrorists to do anything other than a point and shoot, right? But there's an intensity and an urgency to the way that shot that I really like.
Well, you know what that is? It's totally the evening news story thing. You know, where you gotta have somebody walking and talking for a portion of it.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying that as a critique. Like that actually is something good that he sort of picked up on and said, "Yeah, you know what? This is a motif that you see.
Yeah,
we should use that.
Yeah.
Like so. Yeah, good for him.
Yeah, they did it later on in First Contact, where there's a scene where they're in Bozeman, where they're walking through a bunch of smoke to go get beamed out, and it's like you don't need to walk to get beamed out. They can beam you out of anywhere. But it looked cool for them to be walking through smoke. anything else about Shatner's direction you want to touch on, Brian?
No, it's just the raid on Paradise City was nicely done.
Yeah,
I thought.
Yeah,
shot that well.
Mm-hmm.
The he uses the horses, of course. Because he loves horses.
Oh yeah, horses.
Of course. Sorry. Oh, of course. I mean, this would not be a William. This would not be a William Shatner project if there weren't horses involved.
Did you know that William Shatner really likes horses?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, you know, he even has his own charity. Charity horse show.
Oh, does he?
Get out.
I love this scene.
I've never heard such a thing.
Oh, my.
It's a little known. Really? It's a little known fact.
I love the scene in the Get a Life sketch where the Kevin Nealon, the Saturday Night Live, where Kevin Nealon knows that one of Shatner's horses has had a baby that week, and even Shatner doesn't know that.
Yeah. That mare had a foal.
Exactly. I got to say, you know, people, and I mentioned this when we were preparing for this, but I think a lot of people's fondness for this is directly related to how much they can enjoy Shatner's ego about himself, which is one of the things. I mean, I love Bill, and so this is one of the things that makes it a little easier for me to stomach some of this movie, even with some of his shortcomings. And I do think of all the six movies, this is the one where he looks the best. I mean, he really just looks as in as much of his prime as a man in his 50s could. Mm-hmm. So there's that.
Yeah. Maybe,
so let's see. Now, Brian, you wanted to talk about the music, I remember.
Yeah, and I just want to say one more thing. The director of photography, Andrew Laszlo, I thought the movie is actually – the cinematography of the movie is very good, in my opinion. It's very – the stuff that they shoot on Shakari is very nice, and, like, a lot of the stuff at the beginning with Cybok is very cool.
Yeah.
Like – and the movie was shot at the widest aspect ratio of any Star Trek movie.
Interesting.
It's a 2.55:1, which is very wide. Because I think Shatner thought he was going to make some epic movie. The problem is, epic movies cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
He didn't have that kind of money.
This is not Lawrence of Arabia.
No.
Yeah.
But see, he did the right thing, which is, as a first-time director, he surrounded himself with really good people. Like, the DP was good. You mm-hmm. know, he did the right thing there, I think.
Yeah. He did. To go back to what you were saying about Goldsmith, I thought it's one of Jerry's better Star Trek scores. In fact, it's probably, after the motion picture, it's probably his best one. What do you guys think?
No, you see, it's funny. I wouldn't have said that. Like, I wouldn't have agreed with you until I actually did a re-listen to it today, and I'm starting to kind of lean towards, yeah, actually, it's one of his better scores. For me, I always put the motion picture in First Contact as, like, his top two, at least in my mind.
That's how I would do it, yeah. But
but actually, I'm going to give, you know, The Final Frontier, like, maybe a strong third. Like, I'm surprised at how much I liked it when re-listening to it. I was like, oh, right. There's so much to like in it, actually.
Yeah, I need to re-listen to that. I remember at the time when I watched this, hearing the theme song, thinking, like, oh, they just ripped this off from TNG. They're just using the TNG march. And it's like, oh, wait. TNG took that from the motion picture.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
Reusing his own theme.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember thinking the same thing.
Funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. That's cool. I like that. Kayla, what did you think?
I really liked the music in this film. I thought it was the strongest thing about the film, probably, is the music.
Yeah, it might be. It might be. Jerry has a habit of elevating bad Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as I love the motion picture, a lot of the motion picture is his score.
Sure. Yeah, because his score moves it along when it's slow.
Yeah,
yeah. It just captures whatever greatness that movie has. It comes from that score.
The musical trope in this that stands out in my mind the most is Spock playing "Row, Row, Row Your Boat" on the Vulcan lyre. It just sounds sounds lovely. What a great way to send the movie off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Life is but a dream, Jared.
It is. Yeah.
Was that, by the way, was that supposed to mean something?
I think they wanted it to mean something, but it's undeveloped.
They kept calling back to it like, that's like as if that was the theme of the movie or something, and we had just learned about how life is a dream, but we didn't, and so it was really confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lovely sentiment. It just doesn't fit in with the rest of the movie. Yeah.
It goes back to them trying to clutch at something deep that isn't really
there. Right.
Yeah. They're trying to tie the beginning of the movie to the end, and it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I mean, it that's the other thing, is it actually does nicely tie together simply because they go back to Yosemite.
That's the only thing, though.
They didn't need to try so hard,
but
you know what I mean?
Yeah. But they had to put a button on the movie, I guess, so that was their way of doing it.
The other thing about undeveloped themes, and this reviewer, like, he mentioned this, SF Debris, he says, we have Cybok who's trying to find God, he's trying to find the purpose of life or whatever, he comes face to face with his half brother, who has died and been resurrected. You think he might say, "Hey, maybe this guy would have some interesting things to say about the nature of life," and it doesn't come up at all. Instead, no, it comes up with just as a wisecrack. Comes up as a wisecrack when McCoy says, "I liked him better before he died." But yeah, in terms of the nature of existence, life being but a dream, life, the universe, and everything, that would have been something they could have explored, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie, the script for that movie had a lot of compromises attached to it. I mean, the studio put a lot of pressure on them to make a movie that had a lot of comedy in it, because The Voyage Home, it had a lot of comedy in it, and it was a big crossover hit, so they felt obligated to put all those stupid gags in the movie. That's one of the reasons why those gags are there, is because they felt like they had to put them there.
And I remember they were played up very heavily in the advertising campaign. Scotty hitting his head. I remember seeing that in the ad, which ruined the gag, frankly.
Yeah, that's how trailers were back then, though. They would, like, tell the entire plot of the entire film.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now we've got the extreme opposite, where it's, like, some pretty pictures and some cryptic voiceover, and that's it.
And then, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. The horns come out.
Well, I have one final question I want to ask, unless anyone else wants to get in before I ask it.
Go for it.
What, and Kayla, I want to direct this at you specifically. What cosplay options do we have from this film? Because I know you are a better cosplayer than the three of us combined, and you always want to find something that people will recognize, but that hasn't already been done before.
Right.
So, does Final Frontier, as a less loved installment in the franchise, does that have some options for us?
I feel like it totally does. This is a great question. I think the fact that it's one of the lesser beloved films of the franchise makes it that a lot of people don't do cosplays from the Final Frontier.
No.
So, like, Cybok would be the most obvious one.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen him either. So that would be, and that one's not too difficult to do. It's just the getting the robe and doing your hair a bit. But you could go as the trio of ambassadors. That would be funny.
Yeah, that would be good.
Because that's something that they have a specific look to them. And if someone, you know, it's one of those things where, like, a couple of people would be like, "Oh, I know who you are." And then that would make all the effort worth it. I guess you could go as God.
Romulan. I like that one.
You could.
You could wear a giant mask and, like, have clouds around it or something.
So dress up as a big
giant
head.
Yeah, have somebody behind you with a giant spotlight.
Yeah, just be a giant blue head with, like, blue cotton to be, like, clouds, like, coming out from behind the head. And then just wear, like, either blue or black. Could do that.
Yeah.
Could make that out of cardboard, and it'd be pretty hilarious, actually.
I've never seen that. I have genuinely never seen
that. That's, like, a really – I feel like I would do that because it fits my three – criteria for, like, things that I try to do when I do a cosplay, which is one, that it's rare, that's either never been done or rarely done, two, that it's funny, and three, that it's easy to make.
Sure
So that one fits the perfect triad of my type of cosplay, so, like, that's the one I would actually maybe do, just because it'd be funny.
You know, the other thing that you might do would be the if you wanted to do a group costume, would be the three mains with their outfits from the Yosemite, right? Because Kirk's just got, a plaid shirt, so that would be easy. McCoy has his awesome camping ascot, which I mentioned earlier. But then Spock actually has some interesting, like, space sweatpants and a cool, like, space rainbreaker, or whatever you call it, windbreaker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you could be wearing the rocket boots.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, of course, that would be annoying to walk around in that. I know. Could you do that in a way that it wouldn't be terrible?
Yeah,
well,
you could make, like, a thing that goes outside of your regular shoes. So it's just like a facade that looks like a boot, but actually you have regular shoes on. So it doesn't have a bottom to it. You could do that.
All right. Well, let's do that and roast ourselves up some marshmallows.
I think that'd be a pretty funny cosplay. That
the other cosplay you could do would be just get the normal, movie era uniform, and then open it and wear a shirt on the inside that says,
go climb a rock. It's funny you bring that up, because I actually, when I saw that scene as I was doing the rewatch, the first thing I thought was, what a great cosplay.
Oh, I had the same thought. Yep. Okay, so good. We're on the same page with that. Excellent.
See, look at all the possibilities.
And you just need, like, blue jeans.
Sure. Yeah, so the rest would be easy.
Oh, yep. I could even, like, do that now. I just needed to get a Sharpie and a white shirt, and it'd be, go climb a rock on it.
You used to be able to buy those.
Oh, I'm sure you could probably find them somewhere, eBay or something.
Made.
Yeah, I go. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was definitely part of the stuff you could buy around the time. Merch. It was like.
Well, it's currently on Redbubble for $19.50, if anyone's wondering.
There we go. There we go. Easy. Easy peasy. Okay, well, I think we're about ready to close the chapter on this book and put it back on the shelf. Thank you for coming with us. We wanted to talk about this for a while. We know a lot of people have said things about it, so I hope this has had some interesting commentary on the Final Frontier for all of you. And I know, Matt, you had a Trekknecdote you wanted to share about the Kelvinverse, right?
Oh, did I actually say this before? I know I've talked to people about it. I want to be sure this didn't actually make it into a podcast.
I don't remember, but you shared it on our internal thread.
Oh, good. Well, so this one's about our friend Chris Pine here, our buddy from the Kelvin universe. It's kind of funny. I was earlier in the summer, I was watching Wonder Woman with a buddy of mine who's, you know, just a casual kind of action adventure, you know, fan. And he looks at me, kind of nudges me, and he goes, Chris Pine jumps on a motorcycle, of course, in Wonder Woman. And he looks over at me and he goes, see, Captain Kirk on a motorcycle. They had to do it. And I'm just like, oh, okay. So that's what, you know, the average person thinks is like, Kirk just gets on motorcycles. That's the takeaway for them. Like the casual fan of these movies is that's what he do.
That's pretty funny because I thought the same thing when I saw the Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah, instantly I was like, oh okay, I guess that's what Chris Pine does now. You know,
Shatner likes horses. Chris Pine likes motorcycles.
You gotta have your thing, vintage motorcycles.
Yeah, but I guess there you go. That's what the lay people think of like the Kelvin era movies. Is they're just like, well, it's Kirk's on a motorcycle, of course. Like that's what he does. So,
well, there you go.
There you go.
Anyway, all right. Well, this is August 17th, 2017. This is episode 41 of the Shuttle Pod. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Good night, Bones.
Good night, Jim.
Good night, Spock.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night, Spock.
Good night, Jim.